November 16th, 2022. Half moon, lunar observance day. Yesterday, myself, Ajahn Kasapo, Tantra Tapalo, and Debbie, and spent the day at Three Jewels in Fort Bragg, where Metika used to live. And walking in there, her presence was very strong. And I guess part of me thought maybe it was going to look different or something, but of course it looked exactly the same as I should have expected it to look. And there was her chair where she pretty much spent most of the hours of her days, including all night. She would just sleep in this chair. She didn't usually sleep in a bed. She would sleep in this chair, and then had bookshelves near the chair where these bookshelves, books were on hand and could read a Dhamma book from time to time or just sit and meditate in this chair. So there was the chair, there was then meeting up with other people there and deciding what we want to keep, what we want to get rid of in the house, and realizing it's a big job for these fiduciary people to go in and clean out houses of deceased people. And so helping with that and going through things, and it's not a very big house, but I mean, it's a lot of stuff to go through, and it's the various layers of a lifetime. So discovering the different chapters in Metika's life when she was a primary school teacher and what point, and discovering crayons and children's books and so on, and syllabuses for that period of time, and the time when she was practicing with Swami Muktananda and finding things connected with him, and then the early days at Abhayagiri when she was part of the Calm group, so finding things like her just notes and printouts from that era, from that period of time, from about 20 years ago. And then finding her handwritten notes of the letters from Mara that became articles in our newsletter when we used to have a print newsletter. And so making these discoveries and just seeing just how much even a, and this was according to the people who were cleaning the helping clean the house out, this was considered an easy task compared to most people who hoard things. And sometimes you'll have a house of a deceased person and you won't even be able to walk through their house. You actually have to like get a shovel or just kind of clear a path through the house just to even begin starting to sort through all the stuff. So this was considered an easy job. And still it was a lot of stuff. It seemed like a lot. But we did it. And hopefully when we go back next time, the house will be very cleared out and we'll be able to start with a mostly clean slate and see what becomes of it as a new branch monastery of Abhayagiri in the Fort Bragg area. So it's like endings, Metika passing away, but also new beginnings. And what will happen when there's a Sangha presence in a new area, and what will come of it. It's fresh, it's unknown. And something I've been reflecting on as well is just the ordinariness of practice day to day, and just what do we do when things are just ordinary? We're not striving to achieve great things, or we're just going about our ordinary day-to-day life. And I think it's worth recollecting that so often we're building up this really strong and immense sense of self, even as monks, and we don't really realize it, and it's kind of happening all the time. And so even as Dhamma practitioners, and we're taught in the suttas to be calling into question the sense of self and seeing the body as just elements and seeing the mind as just changing conditions, just sankharas. And yet, if we really look with mindfulness and clear comprehension, we can see that we're kind of building up this really strong sense of self all the time. Because it's just a habit to do that. There's a sense of security. I think of it as a false sense of security, being able to have our calendar filled up, being able to have our future lined up for us. There's a sense of comfort, a modicum of comfort that we can get from that, knowing what we're gonna do the next day, knowing our position in society, knowing who and what we are, you know, knowing I'm a monk, I'm supposed to be doing this and that in the monastery, teacher, I'm supposed to be a good example, be acting a certain way. But then what happens when somebody gets, we just act like normal humans, and then somebody might think, oh, that monk isn't as inspiring. So what do we do when people feel uninspired with us based on their own hopelessly high ideals of what monks should be like? So what do we do when other people are uninspired by us? What do we do when we just mess up and make mistakes, which is a very ordinary part of life? So, and what do we do when we feel just low? What do we do when we feel sad? When we feel a little bit depressed, or just things don't really seem to be going our way, or there's some sort of failed expectations? All these things are just ordinary, so how do we relate to these things? I think it's really important just to keep coming back to that idea of dukkha, that sense of things aren't quite right. So to look directly at that, because so often we're always looking outside of ourselves. We're thinking, well, that feeling must be there because there's this person that I find difficult to live with that irritates me, and you know, once they go away, then I'll be happy. Then things will be better somehow. And then they leave, that actually does happen, we actually get what we want, and then that feeling is still there. Or maybe there's a sense of gladness for 1 minute, and then that feeling comes back of things just aren't quite right. And so we think, well, it must have been something else. It must have been that my robe isn't the right color. And when I get the right color of robe, then things will be okay. Or it might be that just I have to do this. I just have to get my meditation together, and then everything will be okay. I have to meditate a certain number of hours a day, then things will be better. Or I need to become more senior. I need to become more senior as a monk, then things will be better. Or all those things then happen, and then that feeling is still there. So it just comes back to what the Buddha is just saying over and over again in the teachings, but it's some of his most ordinary teachings, and therefore we're always wanting to look beyond that, always wanting to overcomplicate things. Like there's these incredibly simple teachings like, do good, you get good, do bad, you get bad. Look at suffering, look at the cause of suffering. There is suffering, there is the cause of suffering, there's the cessation of suffering, and there is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So if you could please not take your phone out during the talk, appreciate it. So looking at those just ordinary things is incredibly important. But we're always looking past it. So looking directly at suffering. So when we feel like anxious or sad or lonely or disheartened or embarrassed, then we look at those basic things like that emotion or that state is like that, rather than trying to pin it on something outside. There may be outside events that trigger these things, but it's just it's so important to look at what is the experience of that. And not in a sense of trying to make it go away, but just trying to gain insight into what does it feel like, what is it like in this moment. So often we try to get away from those states by kind of taking refuge in the future, knowing what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, the next day, the next month, the next year, filling up the calendar, and just trying to know where I'm going to be, what I'm going to be, how I'm going to be. And yet that's a false sense of security, because when that changes or that doesn't come about, there can be suffering. Or if something comes up and everything has to change, are we able to not suffer over not being able to fulfill our plans, our goals and aspirations? So it's kind of coming back just to how things are in the present moment. Can we be open with a sense of not knowing what's going to happen? So Ajahn Dunn would talk about this. This is a really important teaching that he talked about when he was here in 2016, where it dovetails with that Lumpur Viradamo teaching that he was giving when he was just visiting, open unknowingness. Not open knowingness, it's open unknowingness, but unknowingness in terms of we don't know what's going to happen. So there's a sense of openness, and there's an acknowledgement that we don't know what's going to happen, but at the same time there's knowing of the present moment, but it's not knowing in terms of knowing this or that. It's just an openness, a knowing, and a not knowing what's going to happen. So open unknowingness. Because Ajahn Dunn was talking about that. It's a really important teaching. It's this obscure word that comes up in the funeral chanting and the Abhidhamma chanting that we do. It's the Ananyatanyasamitindriyang. It's the one that's really hard, that word that's really hard to memorize. It's knowing and not knowing. Or you could possibly translate it, free translation, open unknowingness. Ananyatanya. Ananyatanya. Ananyatanya sami tindriyang. So there's like knowing and there's not knowing, then there's the open unknowingness. So that openness is like knowing, but then there's the unknowingness of just not acknowledging that we don't really know what the next moment is going to bring. So that in that acknowledgement there is an openness that is created, or is not created, but just kind of allowed. So what do we do when, say, as a monk, what do we do when somebody feels uninspired by our behavior and they let us know that, or they let us express that, or somebody asks a leading question which is kind of indicates they might be upset with us or something like that? You know, what do we do with that? How do we hold that? because that can be very difficult. All this is, but can we be just open to that? Or we might think we know where somebody else is at, but can we acknowledge that it's unknown where that other person is at? It's so often in human relationships that we think another person we're close to should know what we're thinking. We think another person we're close to, whether it's a dear friend or a spouse or a teacher, we think they should know what we're thinking. But it's nearly 100% of the time that other person doesn't know what we're thinking. We actually have to tell people what we're thinking. We actually have to express ourselves. And yet we can go decades feeling like developing negative perceptions about somebody because we're reacting. We think they should know what we're thinking. They should know what we're thinking. They should know where I'm at. If they really love me, they should know where I'm at. They should know what I'm thinking. And it's actually ridiculous, but so many people do it. We all do. I would almost say almost everybody does this. Almost all of us do this. So it's like mindfulness and clear comprehension is like bringing the ridiculousness to light. Maybe that's one possible translation of dukkha, ridiculousness. What's the cause of ridiculousness? What's the cessation of ridiculousness? Path leading to the cessation of ridiculousness. So, because it is, it's ridiculous, but it's absurd. Dukkha, you know, why suffering? But there is a cause to it. There is a cessation of it. This, it's a very simple teaching. Remember one time we going to pay respects to Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche up in Legut, and he gave us this teaching. I think I was in Anagarika at the time, and Longpo Pasano took us to go see this Tibetan meditation master, and he said the reason people don't see the Dhamma is because it's too close to us. We're always looking out. We're always looking away from ourselves. That's the reason we don't see the Dhamma, because it's too close. It's too apparent here and now. It's to what we are. Yeah. It's the living Dhamma. It's birth, aging, sickness, and death. It's our body and mind. That's the Dhamma that we're trying to realize. But we look in books. We look outside of ourselves. Yeah. So we're not really reading the inside the Dhamma of the heart, turning the light around. So can we train ourselves to do that? Can we use the facilities we've got here and the opportunity we have to do that, to really look at this? It's hard to look at dukkha, and it's we're going to see messiness. We're going to see layers of messiness. We're going to see layers of our own life, like discovering the layers of Metta's life, cleaning out three jewels. When we look at dukkha, we're going to dig down like an archaeological dig and see the layers of our own life, and we're going to start to discover things about things that might surprise us about ourselves, both good and bad. We might start to see causes and conditions that we might realize we're just like our parents, not just physically, but our emotional habits come from our parents as well. We might not want to look at that. But then we see how simple it is, how the causes and conditions create where we're at right now. So we need an openness to look at that. We don't know what we're going to discover when we dig down and all these things start getting dredged up. But it's like cleaning house. We want to clean house and get to that point where we have a clean slate. So I think that's what the Buddha's talking about when he's with purity. And then that creates a natural a natural sense of metta or a natural sense of goodwill. Because when we relate to ourselves that way, we'll know that, well, everybody else has this as well. Everybody else has this dukkha. Yeah. So there'll be metta, there'll be karuna, compassion for both ourselves and others when we're able to do this, when we're able to be open in this way. So these are just a few brief thoughts for this evening. I think I'll leave it there.